Get down under your chairs if necessary, so we have folks entering the rotunda and coming down this way. So we'll update you as soon as we can, but just be prepared.
We're going to walk down and I'll be there with you.
Authorities say the dead include a woman who was shot by U.S. Capitol Police, as well as three others who died in medical emergencies.
Threatening the safety of duly elected officials. It's not protest. It's insurrection. I call on this mob to pull back and allow the work of democracy to go forward.
Call it off. The election is over.
Dozens of texts, including from Trump administration officials, urged immediate action by the president. POTUS has to come out firmly and tell the protesters to dissipate. Someone is going to get killed.
As the violence raged, aides urged him to respond, and he reluctantly tweeted his backers should stay peaceful, and then posted a video message.
We love you. You're very special.
Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, I'm pushing it hard. I agree. Still, President Trump did not immediately act.
I know your pain. I know you're hurt.
I think Donald Trump probably should be brought up on treason. This is how coups start.
This plan we had called the Green Bay Sweep.
Do you realize you are describing a coup?
Justice will be done.
It was the saddest day I've ever had as serving as a member of this institution.
Criminal behavior will never dominate the United States Congress.
This is going to be the misdemeanor from hell for Merrick Garland, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden.
This will be a stain on our country, not so easily washed away.
The votes for President of the United States are as follows. Joseph R. Biden Jr. of the state of Delaware has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes.
Everything is different, but nothing has changed. Why is telling the truth hard? I guess in this America, it is.
Those voices tell the story of the violent January 6, 2021 insurrection, when rioters with Trump flags and faces painted with the American flag broke through barricades and attacked Capitol Police officers, all in an attempt to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden as president-elect. Many watched in disbelief. They were wondering what was happening to our democracy. And when the mob finally dispersed, we were left stunned and searching for answers and seeking context. Now, maybe out of this low point, public officials could have worked together to strengthen our democracy and its institutions. But a year later, our democracy is even more fragile as we bear witness to state efforts to restrict access to the ballot box and to empower partisan influence to determine the outcome of future elections. Today, President Biden reflected on the insurrection and the stain it put on our country.
Former president's supporters are trying to rewrite history. They want you to see Election Day as the day of insurrection. And the riot that took place here on January 6th as a true expression of the will of the people. Can you think of a more twisted way to look at this country, to look at America? I cannot.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today on The Takeaway, we're looking back at the Capitol insurrection and its impact on democracy in America. All this hour, we're going to discuss and reflect on what happened in this country 1 year ago and what has happened since. We start with Barton Gellman, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of Dark Mirror: Edward Snowden and the American Surveillance State. His recent article for The Atlantic is Trump's Next Coup Has Already Begun. Okay, we're talking about this new article of yours, and part of what it looks at is people who believed Trump's big lie. Who are those people?
Well, it's interesting. There are a lot of them. They are on the order of two-thirds of all Republican voters, which is a catastrophically high figure when you're talking about people who have completely lost faith in the electoral machinery of this country to give a fair report of the outcome. They are often urban, not just rural voters. They are skewing older. They're employed. Many of them are college educated. It's the whole demographic of Trump support plus more you wouldn't necessarily expect.
That seems to contradict at least a version that we often hear in media or in narratives that say, you know, January 6th was really about these sort of, you know, uneducated, rural, poor whites who showed up at the Capitol. And don't worry, as long as the elites are managing things, everything will be okay. This suggests that even in the context of the elites, we have a group of people who genuinely no longer believe in the American project, at least as it's working right now.
Well, that's right. If you look at the sample of people who were arrested for crimes on January 6th at the Capitol, they're very different from the traditional look of people who were arrested for political violence in this country and overseas.
That the January 6th rioters were not simply a crowd of dispossessed and uneducated troublemakers is an important insight, and it's backed by research from the University of Chicago Project on Security and Threats. Professor Bob Pape directs the project.
Over half of the 700 who broke into the Capitol, who've been arrested so far for breaking into the Capitol, are business owners, CEOs, from white-collar occupations, doctors, lawyers, architects, and accountants.
Now, there's something else notable about these insurgents, where they live. Here's Bart Gellman again.
If you look at the 700 or so people who've been arrested and you go back to what their home counties are, they are much more likely to come from counties in which the white population is on the decline, in which the fraction of the non-Hispanic white population has been diminishing in the past 10 years. And you are also, when you do a national poll on this, as they've done at the University of Chicago, you find that the great majority of people who agree that violence is justified to restore Trump to power also agree that Democrats are trying to use black and brown people and immigrants to replace them in the electorate and to take political power illegitimately. And so they are believers in the great replacement theory, which is the latest incarnation of a racist ideology that says the position of white people is under threat from the rise of minorities.
Is the position of white people under threat from the rise of minorities?
Well, it depends whether you feel like you can build a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy in this country, which is a fundamental challenge for the American experiment. I mean, we do know that sometime around 2045, white people will no longer be an actual majority of the population in this country. That is a terrifying prospect to some of them. And those are the ones, by and large, who are Trump supporters and believers that action has to be taken to prevent the loss of their power and authority.
The belief that violence is acceptable to prevent the loss of power is certainly not unprecedented in American history. And as chilling as it might be to have seen it manifest on January 6th, the imperfect but resilient structures of American democracy have always found a way to recover. So I asked Bart why he believes American democracy might be more fragile now, a year after the insurrection failed.
The reason why the country is at great risk right now of losing its democratic structure is that this popular anger is driving the Republican Party to try to game the system, to try to cook the next election. And that's what I'm talking about. Trump's strategy in his first attempt at a self-coup was to persuade Republican state legislatures in states that Biden had won to reverse the outcome, to disqualify the Biden electors and to appoint Trump electors instead and send those to Congress. He didn't succeed. And he didn't succeed in part because there were people of conscience and goodwill doing their jobs as election administrators around the country. You had the Secretary of State of Georgia. You had a guy from the Board of State Examiners in Michigan. You had the governor of Arizona, all of whom certified Biden's victory and all of whom were themselves Republicans. What's happened since then is that Republican operatives have driven all of those people from office or tried to replace them or tried to remove their power to supervise elections, and with some success. I mean, look at what happened in Georgia. You had Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, who withstood enormous pressure from Trump to try to cook the Georgia election results.
And our investigators have seen no widespread fraud either. Even after this office request that President Trump try and quell the violent rhetoric being born out of his continuing claims of winning the states where he obviously lost, he tweeted out, "Expose the massive voter fraud in Georgia." This is exactly the kind of language that is at the base of growing threat environment for election workers who are simply doing their jobs.
But he insisted that a fair count had shown that Biden won. What's happened since then? Trump has recruited a candidate to run against him and endorse that candidate in the coming election. The state legislature has removed Raffensperger from the board that oversees elections. So one of the main jobs that he had as Secretary of State has now been stripped from him. And for good measure, the state legislature, the Republican legislature, has created a new body that reports to the Republican legislature and given it power to fire election officers in the counties, and particularly in Fulton County, which is the home of Atlanta and the bulk of the Democratic electorate in Georgia. And so at every level, they've assaulted the idea of a free and fair election counted by normal rules and put partisan control over the count itself. This is a much graver threat even than suppressing the vote, because if you can count the vote, you can count whatever you want.
And that's a terrifying prospect for American democracy. On Monday, I spoke with Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, and he highlighted the same issue.
It's not new, this attack on voting rights, but it's a dramatic intensification of an existing trend. And I think the best way to think about it is we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the insurrection. And since the insurrection, the Republican Party has had a single-minded focus on trying to achieve the goals of the insurrection through other means. They were unable to overturn the last election, so they're doing everything they can to rig the next election. And if that doesn't work, to try to overturn it after the fact in a way they couldn't do in 2020.
Now, it can feel like the grave threat has passed. But from what Bart Gellman is saying, it seems that the longer tail, that's the part that's more threatening.
An insurrection that goes unpunished is just rehearsal for the next one. It's just practice. It is not only a unique event in American history to have the American people themselves sacking the Capitol and trying to prevent the certification of a president. It's the beginning of something and not the end of something. And the foot soldiers, the 700 who've been arrested, some for felonies, some for misdemeanors, are being prosecuted. But the people who organized and funded and inspired and called for that violence are not being punished. And as far as we know, not even being investigated by prosecutors. Now, it's possible that there is some secret grand jury operating under the guidance of the Justice Department that is going after the former president for his actions in trying to overthrow an election. It's possible that they're going after the funders. We know that the January 6th committee is interested in investigating these things, but it does not have prosecutorial powers or even influence in that respect. And if those folks go unpunished, there is nothing to prevent them from doing what they're already doing and plotting to do it again.
Bart Gellman is a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the book Dark Mirror, Edward Snowden in the American Surveillance State. I think I want to say thank you, Bart, but I do feel also a bit distressed at this moment.
Exactly how you feel. Thank you for having me.
In years and decades to come, I'm sure we're all going to remember where we were and whom we were with when we watched the events unfold on television. But for some, this was not a televised horror. This was lived experience.
My name is Bonnie Watson Coleman. I represent the 12th District in the state of New Jersey.
I asked the Congresswoman to take me back to that day, 1 year ago, when she and others were under attack by their fellow Americans.
So my day started earlier than the actual insurrection at the Capitol, because I live in an apartment building next to the Republican National Committee. And so we were evacuated from our apartment because there was a bomb supposedly in the back, which they subsequently found out in the back alley. I left there, went immediately to my office. As I was going into the office building, a Capitol Police officer said, "You got to leave here. You can't stay here. It's too close to what's happening." And he said, "Go downstairs and go through the tunnel." Went down through the tunnel, stood for a while in a little cafeteria area, and said to my husband and my staffer who were with me, "I think we should go to the Capitol because we'll be safe there. There are too many people in this cafeteria and there are people who don't have masks on." So we walked through the tunnel over to the Capitol. I went over there. I decided I was going to go to the attending physician's office for something because I had some time. And as I was walking down the hallway to the office, I encountered the first police officer. And he said, "Ma'am, you don't want to go down there because they're going to breach that area." And I said, "Well, I'm just trying to get to the doctor's office." And he kind of shrugged his shoulders and, you know, went in the opposite direction. And then walked a little ways more and encountered another officer. He said, "Ma'am, don't go down there. They are breaching now." He kind of stood in front of me as I walked down another hallway. And as I walked down the hallway, all these doors opened up saying, "Come shelter, come shelter, come shelter." So we ended up sheltering one of the small offices next to the attending physician's office. And we were there. We could hear things, but we didn't really have a good sense of what was happening inside. Had a small TV on, Melissa. Could see activity on the outside a little bit. But I could hear USA, USA chanting. I could hear stomping inside. And my thought was, "Oh my God, who's ever doing that? I feel sorry for them because the Capitol Police are going to shut them down." Little did I know that the opposite was happening. So we were there for, I guess, maybe a couple of hours. I'm not sure. And we had this knock at the door and they said, "Come out. We've got to get you out of here." And I'm like, "Who are you?" And so they were saying, "Well, we're Capitol Police." I'm like, "Show me your identification." And they held it up over a transom so I could see it. And somebody else tried to put it under the door so I could see it. So the nurse that was there, my husband, my staffer, and I went with the Capitol Police down through the tunnels. And they took us to a large room where they were holding everybody and where they had security outside. It was in there that we were for quite a while. And when it was in there, where one of my colleagues tried to give some of my other colleagues masks and they refused to take them. And so we were there until we got an all clear sign. We left there. I ended up in the whip's office upstairs, waiting until we were going to be called to vote. So we were there for a couple of hours. Then we were called to vote, and we did. And as I was leaving the whip's office, I saw Capitol Police officers just like drained, absolutely drained, sitting down on the floor. You saw debris on the floor outside of the office. Went in and voted and went home, then really saw what was happening on TV. And was absolutely mortified that I was in the middle of it and didn't realize how dangerous it was.
So you ended up with a positive COVID diagnosis after this. Talk to me about where that exposure happened. You were talking about trying to give masks to some of your other colleagues.
We were in the large room where they were holding members and staff. And there were a number of people in there, some members, I think even some staff, who weren't wearing masks. So one of my colleagues had some of the cloth of the disposable masks and was trying to give them out, and they were being declined. So we were in that room with people who didn't have masks. After we voted, we went back to our apartment, and the next day we left. And the very next day, I got a call from the attending physician's office saying there were some positive people in that holding room to get tested. I got tested and I tested positive. And so they sent me to get monoclonal antibodies. And the doctor said to me, you know, thank God you had one shot already. And you had, we got the infusion of monoclonal antibodies that probably saved your life. So that was a frightening prospect, just kind of retrospectively looking on it, you know, but thanking God that that was the case.
Representative Watson Coleman, when you say that, I have to say, like, you know, when we talk about and remember January 6th, we typically think of the only source of, particularly of life-threatening danger, as having come from the outside, from those who were, you know, breaching the Capitol. But that's quite something to say that you were actually in a situation where it was a, you know, potentially a threat from the inside, right? That that someone who chose not to protect you and other members of the staff, other members of the U.S. Congress, by doing something as simple as wearing a mask in the context of such a difficult situation.
Yeah, I know it's really not understandable, because it is a very simple thing to have done, just recognizing that we were all in this together. But this this buying into the big lie, or this defiance that we saw from members of the Republican conference, just makes no sense. The politicization of this health scare and this threat to our well-being, it just makes no sense. And so the threat was from the inside as well. It was from that perspective. It was also from the perspective that we potentially have members and staff members who were colluding with the folks who were creating all the damage and wreaking all the havoc and creating the dangerous situation, the insurrectionists. So, you know, when you look at it all around, it was a pretty terrifying moment. For me, it was watching it, because while I was in the midst of it, I couldn't see all that was going on.
I want to stick with that phrase for a second. When I was in the midst of it, I couldn't even see all that was going on. With the value of a year now, right, of looking back, what do you now see? And particularly, I have to say, as I remember watching it, right, I think all of us, none of us will forget the experience of watching it. You couldn't have told me a year ago, January 6th, that so little accountability would have been put into place by now. I would absolutely have presumed much more and much higher profile accountability than we have seen. Are you at all surprised by that?
Well, I'll tell you, I think, you know, the wheels of government kind of run very, very slow, as we know. I think the fact that we weren't getting any cooperation from the Republican conference and getting some of these answers contributes to that. I think the January 6th committee is doing a good job of trying to get the information, get the answers to the questions, get the folks who have that information before them, make sure that there's some accountability. I think there's a lot more going on with that committee than even members of Congress who are not on that committee, let alone people in our respective communities know. I just hope that when it's time to hold these public hearings, that they're given the kind of airtime that we had during the Nixon issue, during the 9/11 issue, because it is that threatening. It is that serious. This is a serious threat to our government, our governance, our democracy. And we need to have this in front of people so that they don't forget, nor do they think that this was just something that happened on one day and it'll never happen again. We're in a very dangerous environment right now. We don't know what to expect.
Over the course of the past year, I'm wondering if you have experienced either greater sense of trust with your fellow members, given that you had this shared frightening experience, or if a year after the January 6th insurrection, trust, not so much trust in Congress, but trust among those who serve in our legislature, has it deteriorated?
Well, I'll tell you, there are members who aren't cooperating right now. We've got one member who refuses to wear her mask every single day that she's on the floor. There's this total disrespect for anybody else. I can't believe that they don't recognize the health threat that COVID presents, because they were smart enough to get elected. So they're smart enough to read. They're smart enough to have gotten vaccinations throughout their lives for various things. So to be this disregarding, this stupid, and this mean, to not protect your fellow members and other folks that you encounter, is just, it's inexplainable. I mean, I've just never seen anything like this. And when I see what happened on the 6th, played over and over and over again on the various news programs, it is frightening. It is, it brings a sense of trauma back to you that, oh my God, I was in the middle of this. And oh my God, I was not that far from where they were breaching. And oh my God, if they saw me with the pin, I would have been I would have been fodder for them as well. They didn't care who it was. They were just an angry mob determined to disrupt government.
Are you feeling hopeful these days about our democracy?
I am. You know what? I'm really scared that the people are not paying enough attention, are not yelling enough, are not collectively saying, we know that our democracy was challenged. We see what's happening in states that will thwart the opportunity and accessibility to voting. We can tell what the plan is to interrupt democracy and elections. So I want to make sure that everybody is constantly aware of it. I mean, Melissa, I said to my husband and my staffer, let us go to the Capitol. We will be safe there. If you can't be safe in the citadel of democracy, with all of the kind of security that's supposed to be there, you can't be safe anywhere. And so it is frightening today, because you know that there are people who are plotting something, you just don't know what. There are people who are hell-bent on disrupting government because they don't believe it works. They still buy into a lie that this maniac former president perpetuates. I don't understand how people could be so ignorant and evil at the same time here.
What does give you hope in our democracy? What are the moments that maybe are far from the view of the public, but maybe particularly over the past year, where you thought, okay, because you're still waking up, you're still going to the citadel of our democracy, you're still serving. Why?
Because we have to, because we can't let things of that nature stop our government from working. We've got to be stronger than that. We've got to stand up for that. We have a responsibility to those who elect us. And if we believe that democracy is the form of government that we think is the best form of government, then we've got to literally stand up for it and do whatever is necessary. I have a lot of confidence in the January 6th committee. I have a lot of confidence in the Democratic caucus. I have no confidence in the Republican conference. I think they're doing everything they can to disrupt, to destroy, and to perpetuate continuous lies. But I think that at the end of the day, if we can get our message out, if we get the kind of fair coverage of the hearings that are going to take place, people will see for themselves. You know, it's hard to understand how members of families who are not vaccinated and die still refuse to get vaccinated. I don't know what it takes, but I know we can't give up.
Congresswoman Bonnie Watson Coleman of New Jersey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a blessed year.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you.
When an angry, violent mob of mostly white Trump supporters overran the Capitol, the first people I called to make sense of it were historians. It's historians who keep our collective record and help us make sense of our own moment.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History in the Department of History at The Ohio State University.
Professor Jeffries' research and teaching explore the long history of Black struggle, and his work reminds us that the violence we saw at the Capitol 1 year ago is not an anomaly. In fact, political violence has long been a feature of how white supremacy has asserted itself in this country. Earlier this week, Professor Jeffries tweeted, quote, "Dear teachers, don't pretend that January 6 didn't happen." So I asked him about it.
Well, first, I understand that given all that's going on with COVID and return to school, that nothing is normal in this particular moment. So I understand that. And also, we're also asking a lot of our teachers because of they've been on the front lines of this unfortunate culture war, right? This battle designed to not teach accurate history. And so there's a lot on their table. But having said all that, don't be scared, right? Don't be scared to talk about what happened on January 6th. And the way to do it, but you have to do it in a particular way, right? And I think there's a number of important approaches that teachers should take at all grade levels, age appropriate, of course. I mean, one is to put it in historical context. What we saw on January 6th is an extension of a long history of political violence that we have in American history. I mean, dating back to the founding of this nation through the Civil War, through the end of Reconstruction, the battles to extend voting rights to African Americans and the like. So there is a history to this, but the history isn't even that remote. I mean, so the historical context also means that the reason why these people stormed the Capitol, the supporters of Donald Trump, who were animated by his belief in white supremacy and the shared belief in white supremacy, was their thinking that the election was stolen because Black people participated in it, right? That racism is essentially what was fueling this. And that has a long history as well that needs to be discussed. So putting it in historical context is one approach. But then also, we can also approach this, and teachers should also approach this, as simply, how do we understand the functioning of government? I mean, the reason why the people were there is because they believed, some of them, that somehow they could stop this transfer. And they're like, what are you talking about? That's not the way the Constitution works. I need you to know some basic civics. So there is there's a civics lesson that needs to be discussed. And that in the absence of that, in the absence of understanding the way basic government works in American society, you literally have people storming the Capitol and losing their lives. And so you have that. And then there's a third approach, a third reason why we should be teaching this or use this as a point of entry, and that is critical media literacy. I mean, part of the reason why people are there is because they believe the big lie. And the big lie is being pushed on us, and it's only escalated over the last year, this idea of rampant voter fraud, electoral fraud. So how can you, as students, be able to look out there and analyze for yourself, you know, evidence and arguments? And so that is another approach. And then I think, fourthly, another reason why this needs to be addressed in the moment, one, because it points to the fragility of our democracy. So this goes back a little bit to, well, we're not on this sort of perpetually ascendant streak, if you will, right, where things will just always get better. Our democracy is safe. If you understand how fragile this democracy is, if you understand, you know, how this thing actually works, you can realize that there's no guarantee that this is going to be around. And not just in 100 years or 200 years and 300 years. I mean, in 6 months, right? I mean, this whole thing could unravel. And so the stakes are very high. And we can't afford to pretend as though what we saw there was a blip on the map, right? This is portending something very dangerous, not only for the fate of Black folk or for the fate of marginalized people. We're talking about the fate of the nation. And I don't think that's hyperbole.
Historical context, foundational civics, critical media literacy, and a robust discussion of what's at stake. Sounds like a lesson plan to me. Now stick with us. We'll be back with more from Professor Jeffries and with more guests as we discuss the connections between civics education and the events of January 6th.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway, where we've been discussing how teachers might approach lessons about the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol a year ago. Now, there's no doubt about it. This is a tough time to ask any more from our teachers, as we were reminded by one of our listeners.
Teachers are trying to deal with COVID this week. Nobody's teaching a lesson about the January 6th insurrection, unfortunately. Tia Creighton, San Francisco Bay Area.
But still, because teachers are real and actual superheroes, many are still finding ways to tackle this challenging topic. And we heard from some of you about this.
Jerise in Washington Heights, New York, this semester. I'm teaching about the Renaissance and later. I want to focus more on the development of governmental structures, concepts such as citizenship and the ways in which groups of citizens have been able or not able to hold their governments accountable throughout that period.
Thanks to all the educators who called in to share with us, and thanks to all the teachers throughout the country who are working so hard in such challenging times. Because, of course, teachers matter. And last year's Capitol riot might be one of the clearest examples we have of just how much they matter.
These are the battles we're fighting right now over both whether we support our schools financially with proper funding, but also just whether we support a climate of learning and inquisition. You know, the fundamental question about education in America right now is, do we want to raise critical thinkers?
This is Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And earlier this week, Will penned a piece linking the attack on the Capitol to our national disinvestment in K-12 civics education.
I would say maybe around the 1980s when we start developing these new focuses on K-12 education to put such a greater emphasis on test scores and, you know, really in a couple different subjects, math and reading scores. And educators started changing the curriculum in their schools so that kids would do better on these tests. And what got lost in that is, you know, the idea of a broad liberal education, as it's called, or someone might call it a general education. You know, this idea that education is really kind of more about workforce development in the end than creating a well-rounded citizen. And so one subject that really, really has suffered a lot during this whole changing of the guard has been civics. You know, the classes that used to be kind of de rigueur in any kind of public high school or even middle school, where people took classes in how government worked, the old cliche of how a bill becomes a law, but people used to learn that in the classroom, you know, what the Supreme Court does and how many justices there are. That really became one of the first subjects to fall in this new regime, because that's something that's really geared towards making you a better citizen, not towards making you a better worker within the capitalist system.
Public schools, they started to emphasize test scores as the primary assessment of learning in the 80s, but the practice of high stakes testing became an almost singular driver of content and practice in K-12 public ed beginning 20 years ago with the passage of No Child Left Behind. And what No Child Left Behind meant is that every state was required to test every child in third through eighth grade every year. And the results weren't just benchmarks. Those test outcomes have serious consequences for schools and sometimes even for entire school systems. And they only focused on math and reading. So among the many consequences of this testing obsession has been severe underinvestment in the arts, sciences, and notably in civic, government, and social studies education. In fact, a 2018 report from the Brown Center on Education at the Brookings Institution showed math and reading scores initially increase and then plateau after No Child Left Behind was implemented. But the hours that elementary school kids received civic education, it dropped. And along with it, civic knowledge plummeted among American school kids.
We're so worried about our civil political society. You know, there's so much misinformation. There's so much division. And you just can't help but think that these two things are a coincidence, you know, that just in the last couple of years, the misinformation we've seen flourish about vaccines, about climate change, and now most dramatically in the last 13 or 14 months, you know, Donald Trump's big lie about the 2020 election, the motivator behind the January 6th insurrection, would that have gained so much traction if we had a better educated, better informed citizenry about how elections work and how government works?
It's not just a matter of knowing how government works. The lessons of our civic education are the basis for building an equitable society or a resentful one.
This whole idea that in some schools, kids are just seen as fodder to be churned out for maybe the local factory, or if they're in a city, they talk about kids being on the McDonald's track, that at an early age, they're singled out as people who possibly aren't college material. And this idea of unequal opportunities and unequal access to learning opportunities, I think, is really behind a lot of the resentment that you see in society. And, Donald Trump was a master at playing off this resentment, you know, that the media is looking down on you, the college professors are laughing at you, are looking down at you. And I think that's been just a big driver of division.
This does not mean hardworking social studies teachers are at fault for the violence at the Capitol last January. Research shows that despite disinvestment, many primary and secondary school teachers work hard to ensure their students learn the fundamentals of American history and government.
My name is Cassandra Dillard, and I'm a senior writer for Learning for Justice, which is a project of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
I spoke with Cassandra about her work with Learning for Justice, which provides free resources to educators who work with children from K through 12. And they've compiled helpful resources for teaching about January 6th. Cassandra pointed out that many teachers have a longstanding commitment to this kind of civics education.
Our audience, for example, they are committed to social justice education. They're committed to teaching the hard history and wanting the support, not just from us and other organizations, but also from the administrators, the principals, and the parents and communities to help do this work.
For much of 2021, the highly politicized battle over public school curriculum has been framed as a fight about critical race theory. But Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Inquirer told us this is a much larger and older fight about the fundamental purposes of public education.
You know, and this is a debate we've been really having since the 1960s, since increasing college attendance was linked to more and more people protesting the war in Vietnam or protesting for civil rights. And I think what we're seeing now is a continuation of this 60-year-old conversation about what is the purpose of education? Is it to create better citizens, or is it to create workers who will be obedient but efficient workers in the workforce?
That was Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Resent You, How College Broke the American Dream and Divided the Nation and How to Fix It. The core motivation behind the violence we saw a year ago is a belief in the big lie, that self-serving falsehood perpetrated by former President Trump himself, that the 2020 election had been stolen.
If you count the legal votes, I easily win. If you count the illegal votes, they can try to steal the election from us.
Now, to guide us through some of the implications of this big lie, we return to Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University. Now, in full disclosure, I've known Professor Jeffries since we were both doctoral students at Duke University more than 20 years ago. And at that time, I think we both saw ourselves as inheritors of a Black radical intellectual tradition whose central feature has been critique of the American political project. So I wondered if Professor Jeffries was surprised to discover that we are now among those who are defending the legitimacy of the American electoral system.
The reality is that those of us, scholars who have spent our professional career studying the past, but even just Black folk intuitively, right, who have understood with a factual-based skepticism and recognized and experienced the shortcomings in American democracy, can also recognize when the darn thing was working, right? I mean, so it's not that we don't know, or so the wool has been pulled over our eyes. We know what disenfranchisement looks like. We know what voter suppression looks like. And we know, as both scholars and people of color and folk who have been victimized by a long history of disenfranchisement, that it still was in operation, right? I mean, people participated despite the attempts to suppress the vote. And so it really is, you know, the folk who were complaining about voter fraud, I mean, it's creating these solutions in search of a problem that doesn't exist. And so that is part of the great irony. And I think why January 6th needs to be taught and taught honestly, because it's based on this lie that there was massive voter fraud, that there was massive disenfranchisement in some way, shape or form, and cheating and stealing. And that just didn't happen. It just didn't happen.
Professor Jeffries also pointed to another important feature of Black political history that stands in stark contrast to the violence initiated by the big lie. Hope.
Despite the hell that Black folk have caught in this country for 400 years, we have never sought to overrun the Capitol. But we have acknowledged and said, you know what, there is something here that can be built upon. So there's been, I wouldn't say an optimism or even a faith, but there's been a hope. There's been a sense of humanity that despite how rigged this thing, despite how awful this thing is, we can make something of it. It is both shocking and disturbing that those who have benefited the most from this system would turn on it the way they did. And so I think there is something to be said by the hope that Black folk have and the belief that Black folk have in turning something good out of what really has been horrible and set up to be horrible and not to benefit people of color, Black folk, Native American folk, Latino folk. And still, that's the hope. That's what Americans don't get. Like, if y'all would just listen to Black people, just listen to Black women, right? We'd be in a much better place, because that is the hope that carries people. That's the hope that has made this a more expansive democracy. So on the one hand, you got Black folk who are rallying around hope and saying, look, it's far from perfect, but it can be better if you invest. White supremacy doesn't allow you to do that. White supremacy is all or nothing. And that's what those folk were rallying around, this belief in white supremacy. It's either everything for us or nothing at all, or we're going to burn it down.
Hope. Black folks' tenacious, collective insistence that America can and must embody her highest ideals and her most soaring aspirations. This is the hope we heard from Elizabeth Alexander's inaugural poem in January 2009, when President Obama first took the oath of office.
Say it plain, that many have died for this day. Sing the names of the dead who brought us here, who laid the train tracks, raised the bridges, picked the cotton and the lettuce, built brick by brick the glittering edifices they would then keep clean and work inside of.
This is the hope echoed by inaugural poet Amanda Gorman in January of 2021, when the insurrection was quelled and power peaceably, if painfully, passed to President Joe Biden.
And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gazes not to what stands between us, but what stands before us.
So I asked Professor Jeffries if he's feeling hopeful. After all, for him, January 6th was not just a political crisis or a historic occurrence. It was a deeply personal day. Professor Jeffries is the younger brother of Representative Akeem Jeffries, who represents the 8th Congressional District of New York and serves as chairman of the House Democratic Caucus.
It got really personal really quick, not only because, you know, my brother's a sitting member of Congress, as you pointed out, was there, and I couldn't reach him. And so as the shock of what was happening became clear and that this is a really dangerous situation, I mean, I was worried, you know, just in general for the fate of the nation, but also, is my brother going to be okay? And thankfully he was, you know, I was able to reach him eventually. But just as I was able to reach him, then I start receiving these death threats connected to him, saying that we have people outside of your house and we're watching this and make sure your brother stops this and the other. And I'm, you know, my brother still owes me a Thanksgiving meal or something, you know, for taking that flack on. But I don't know what's happening, right? So I got to gather my family together and leave the house because, you know, you're showing pictures of my house, right? Like, what is happening here? So then next thing you know, I got the Capitol Police calling me. I got the FBI calling me, right? Saying, hey, we're going to investigate this. You know, the special agent calling became my best friend, right? Like, we're going to send somebody out outside your house and all this. You know, Melissa, a week in, I was like, you know, I got cops driving by waving at me. So then they promised to catch the guy. I'm like, how are you going to catch this guy? You know, who are these people? But they catch the guy, right? And then he gets sentenced to 3 years, right? Because it wasn't just me and my family, right? I mean, he was targeting these other people. And the judge was like, yo, you're getting 3 years. He got 3 years for this. So in the end, there was a modicum of justice in that sense. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. But it is a traumatic experience because, you know, I explained to my daughters, why do we have to leave? And this is connected to what's happening on January 6th. But it's the reality. Like, look, when in American history have black folk ever been safe? All right. Especially when we're talking about these questions of political violence and politics and democracy. So it was a lesson in, you know, what does it mean to participate in the political process? But it also shows the potential impossibility that there can be accountability, there can be justice. But it also needs to be in the classroom a conversation about accountability and justice. Who should be held accountable for this? Is it just the individual, you know, who's animated by this white supremacy and sending threatening messages to people? Or should it also be the people who are galvanizing this, who are purposefully perpetuating these lies? And should they be held accountable? And what does justice look like in that regard as well?
Indeed. What does justice look like? And who else must be held accountable? Thank you to Professor Hassan Jeffries, Associate Professor of History at The Ohio State University. That's all we have for y'all today, and we truly appreciate that you spent part of your day with us. We're going to continue our coverage and discussion of January 6th in the months to come as more information comes to light. Call us with show ideas and suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or jump on the Twitters and send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. So meet me right back here tomorrow for some political talk.